Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hermandad, soy hombre, duro poco y es enorme la noche, pero miro hacia arriba.
Another day of drug violence in Mexico.
Agents of Mexico's federal police.
At least 25 people were killed within 24 hours in the beach town of Acapulco.
Las estrellas escriben. Sin entender, comprendo. También soy escritura y en este mismo instante alguien me deletrea.
Handwritten messages known as calling cards of drug cartels were left on the bodies.
What sort of a place is Mexico today? And what songs do its poets sing? The land of Octavio Paz and Carlos Fuentes is also home to a thriving narco literature, not surprisingly for a nation notorious for drugs and violence. Impunity is a word you hear a lot in conversation in the capital, Mexico City, referring both to the drug barons and to the politicians who are widely held to be in hock to them. But Mexico is also rich in children's book illustrators and short story writers and positively pullulating with poets. As London discovered this week when dozens of them descended on the London Book Fair for the start of a year-long programme of cultural exchange between the two countries. The up-and-coming novelist Valeria Luiselli explained why, from a Mexican perspective, this feels necessary.
Well, there's a disconnection, a great disconnection, or just a kind of unilateral relation, if you will. I think that most writers in the Mexican tradition have read widely sometimes, and sometimes at least have a cursory knowledge of the English tradition. And the English tradition began to be translated in Mexico quite early, in the early 1920s, by a Mexican essayist, poet, writer, and translator called Alfonso Reyes, who translated Stevenson and Charles Lamb and Chesterton very, very early on. And those voices remained in the Mexican tradition. I think most of the Mexican readership, I guess cultivated readership, reads in English anyway. So translation into Spanish is not such a huge thing, although everything does anyway get translated. There's no need to stress that it's really not the other way around. I can imagine that there are very few writers and readers in the English tradition that are even interested in what's going on in the Latin American sphere.
We'll be hearing more from Luiselli later about her own new novel. But first, I went to the country's capital to find out more about it at first hand. Mexico City is a metropolis of some 21 million people, where recently discovered Aztec pyramids jut out from the foundations of a cathedral that is tipsily subsiding into the swamp on which the city is built. Escaping from the gridlock of the city streets into an airy office surrounded by lush tropical gardens, I met up with Enrique Kraus, historian, publisher and journalist, who worked with the Nobel laureate Paz on the literary journal Vuelta early in his career and is keeping the flame burning for a great Mexican tradition of the public intellectual.
Mexico has undergone many crises. Mexico is a country which has great expertise in crisis, but it also has a great expertise in crisis solving. 68, 76, 82, 88, 94, every 6 years, we have our appointment, punctual, we have a crisis. And it's a resilient country. It's a strong country. And there's something important to say also about the strengths of Mexico. Since December 1st, 1934, this country has taken oath, a new president every 6 years, since 1934. So we have more than 80 years of institutional continuity. That is something that you don't find in any other country in Latin America. There's no other country with this institutional continuity. Well, that all is in danger now, because people are truly enraged. And there's this deep discontent. And who knows what can happen.
Various people have mentioned that Mexico punches beneath its weight in terms of its export of culture internationally. So the books are not translated as much as some other Latin American countries. Why is it underrepresented? There's obviously a very rich tradition here.
You're talking about culture or in particular the literature?
Well, let's start with literature.
Well, I think we have been a country of wonderful poets, good essayists and historians. There have been some good novelists, but I would say poetry is one of Mexico's strengths. So one reason, strange reason, is novels are more popular than poetry or essays, no? So it's a complicated answer. There are some wonderful poets that should have been translated and promoted elsewhere, aside from Octavio Paz and some others, but of course we have Paz. But aside from Paz, there have been, and there are now, wonderful poets. But poetry sells less. Then, with essayism, well, I would say in that case, it is a bit unfair, because for some reason, thought, essayism, if it comes from the Spanish-speaking world, is taken a bit less seriously in the English-speaking world. I mean, if you consult some anthologies, and you would find José Ortega y Gasset, the famous Spanish philosopher, you can find Unamuno, and you can find probably Octavio Paz, but very little. So it's very hard for an essayist to try there. I've been trying, doing what I can.
But you write for the American press,
yeah,
you?
Well, it's taken me, I'm 67, it's taken me long, and two thick books and lots of work. And it hasn't been easy, no? Novelists, well, there's Fuentes and there are others. I think we've been less brilliant in history in novels, that's my opinion. Although we have Juan Rulfo, for instance, that is extraordinary. So that's the reason. And there have been very good short story writers that should have been promoted better. But, well, I guess it's a matter of not insisting, not having the right agents. I don't know. But I think Mexico is undergoing a good moment in poetry, always, and that's my opinion, and in essayism. I mean, we have given lots of thought to thought, and we're doing our best.
Las barandillas del puente se menean cuando paso.
Krauss may hold that Mexico is a land of poets and essayists, but its novelists cannot be so easily dismissed. After all, when novelist Carlos Fuentes died in 2012, he was given a state funeral, headed by the president himself, even though Fuentes had often been critical of the country's politicians. Fuentes belonged to Latin America's boom generation, along with the Peruvian Mario Vargas Llosa and the Colombian Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who lived in Mexico City on and off for 50 years before his death there last year. They cast a heavy shadow across the generation that came after them, as Jorge Volpi explained over a gourmet dinner of ants' eggs and corn fungus, two of Mexico's more recherché delicacies.
20 years ago, a group of five Mexican writers, very young at the time, we decided to create a new literary group, not a generation, but a group. We were admirers of the writers of the boom generation. Carlos Fuentes, García Márquez, Vargas Llosa, Cortázar, Donoso, Gabriel Infante, etc. So we admired them a lot. But at the time, it was almost an obligation for a Latin American writer to write magical realism in the style of García Márquez. If you write another kind of literature, it was almost impossible to be published, and especially to be translated into other languages, because the exotism of Latin American literature was centered on magical realism. And that was a misconception, of course, as usually is the case with the huge success, because the only magical realist in the boom was García Márquez. Vargas Llosa was a realist, Carlos Fuentes, realist and fantastic, Cortázar, another kind of fantasy, but the only one who actually wrote magical realism was García Márquez. But the idea was that the boom was magical realism, and more than that, that all Latin American literature was settled in magical realism, because that was the way in which the soul of the Latin American writers was expressed. We weren't surprised by all the marvels that were around us. We weren't surprised either by the dictatorships or the guerrillas that were in Latin America at the time. So this misconception was very strong at the time. We decided, with the greatness from young writers, to create a new group, to choose another word in English, like boom, and we decided to use the word crack.
It's a slightly unfortunate word in connection with Mexico, isn't it?
Very unfortunate, because at the time, we weren't aware that the crack was a drug. We were very naive at the time, and we were thinking only in the Spanish meaning of crack. Fisura, resquebrajadura, a crack on the tradition. So we wanted to return to the basement of the boom, to the main works of the boom generation, without the idea of being magical realists. And we launched this literary group almost 20 years ago, and it was a little scandal in the literary milieu here in Mexico, because the press wrote that we wanted to become a generation and not only a group, that we wanted the role of the great boom writers at the time, and that we were against García Márquez, especially, and against the boom in general, because we didn't want at the time to be part of this narrative of exotism that was imposed for the Latin American literature at the time. That was 15 years ago, and right now the question is no more why a Latin American writer doesn't write about Latin America. So I think that we have a more wide conception of literature. Latin America is not right now exactly this producer of exotism that was in the 80s and in the 90s. Cuando pasó
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This is the biggest story in the world.
We will look back on these times and we will think, what on earth were we doing?
From The Guardian.
This is a story about people, and this is a story about possibility.
It's a story that's eluded us for decades. A topic which The Guardian is now throwing itself wholeheartedly into.
I'd seen how we'd done it on other things.
Climate change. So
So we're letting you in behind the scenes. Editorial meetings, bids for commissions. You'll hear what works, as well as our mistakes. And along the way, you can judge how we do. Is there a new way to make the world care? The biggest story in the world on The Guardian. Jorge Volpi's novels include The Search for Klingsor, about an American physicist's bold attempts to unmask Hitler's chief science advisor. The crack generation have in turn now become part of the literary establishment. So what of the younger generation of writers? They're alive and kicking, but not necessarily in Mexico itself, as Richard Lee discovered when he caught up with Yuri Herrera. If nothing else, Mexico is a country of long and porous borders. Born in Actopan in 1970, Herrera has been crossing them ever since, studying in Mexico and the United States before teaching literature both north and south of the Rio Grande. His third novel, Signs Preceding the End of the World, follows a girl from Little Town as she enters this border country.
Inside, there were probably no more than five drunks. It was hard to tell for sure because there was often one face down in the sawdust. The place smelled, as it should, of piss and fermented fruit. In the back, a curtain separated the scum from the VIPs. Though it was just a piece of cloth, no one entered the inner sanctum without permission. "I don't have all day," Makina heard Mr. H say. She pulled the curtain aside and behind it found the bird print shirt and glimmering gold that was Mr. H playing dominoes with three of his thugs. His thugs all looked alike, and none had a name as far as she knew, but not one lacked a gat. Thug 45 was on Mr. H's side playing against the two thugs 38. Mr. H had three dominoes in his hand and glanced sidelong at Makina without setting them down. He wasn't going to invite her to sit. "You told my brother where to go to settle some business," said Makina. "Now I'm off to find him." Mr. H clenched a fist around the bones and stared straight at her. "You going to cross?" he asked eagerly, though the answer was obvious. Makina said yes. Mr. H smiled, sinister, with all the artlessness of a snake disguised as a man coiling around your legs. He shouted something in a tongue Makina didn't speak, and when the barman poked his head around the curtain, said, "Some pulque for the young lady." The barman's head disappeared, and Mr. H said, "Of course, young lady, of course. You're asking for my help, aren't you? Too proud to spell it out, but you're asking me for help, and I, look at me, I'm saying, of course." Here came the hustle. Mr. H was the type who couldn't see a mule without wanting a ride. Mr. H smiled and smiled, but he was still a reptile in pants. Who knew what the deal was with this heavy and her mother? She knew they weren't speaking, but put it down to his top dog hubris. Someone had spread that he and Cora were related, someone else that they had a hatchet to bury, though she'd never asked, because if Cora hadn't told her, it was for a reason. But Makina could smell the evil in the air. Here came the hustle. "All I ask is that you deliver something for me. An itty-bitty little thing. You just give it to a compadre and he'll be the one who tells you how to find your kin." Mr. H leaned over toward one of the 38 thugs and said something in his ear. The thug got up and versed from the VIP zone. The barman reappeared with a dandy full of pulque. "I want pecan pulque," Makina said, "and I want it cold. Take this frothy shit away." Perhaps she'd gone too far, but some insolence was called for. The barman looked at Mr. H, who nodded, and he went off to get her a fresh cup. The thug returned with a small packet wrapped in gold cloth, tiny, really, just big enough to hold a couple of tamales, and gave it to Mr. H, who took it in both hands. "Just one simple little thing I'm asking you to do. No call to turn chicken, eh?" Makina nodded and took hold of the packet, but Mr. H didn't let go. "Knock back your pulque," he said, pointing to the barman who'd reappeared, glass at the ready. Makina slowly reached out a hand, drank it down to the dregs, and felt its sweet earthiness gurgle in her guts. "Cheers," said Mr. H. Only then did he let the bundle go.
So where did this story of border crossings start?
Well, you know, with every story I write, I have what I call a different core. This core sometimes is an image, sometimes it's an anecdote, sometimes it's a sensation or a relationship between two different individuals. In the case of Signs, the core of the story was the idea of a certain trip, but not like a trip of a backpacker through Europe or not a trip of a businessman, but I was thinking the kind of trip that immigrants do all the time. And from that core, the rest of the story started proliferating. Really, really soon I knew that I wanted to tell the story of the trip of a woman. I have seen throughout my life that the people that have it harder when crossing borders, when adapting to a new place, are women. You know, women are the ones that are that have to endure the worst part of the immigration problems. So I have been living in 7 cities in the last 10 to 15 years, so that the idea of the trip as something that transforms you, that brings some questions to all the certainties you have lived with, it was really important to me. So I would say that the idea of this trip made by the woman was the starting point for me.
Do you think if the 21st century is in some sense a century of divisions, of borders that are crossed or not crossed, that writers who cross these borders have kind of privileged access to these issues?
Well, to these issues, yes. But what I would say is this. This, what I like to call lo fronterizo, which I would translate as the border condition, as a condition in which the citizens start challenging their own certainties about the stability of laws, language, and identities, is something that happens in the borders in between different countries. But nowadays, it's not limited to only these places. The border condition, to me, happens in every place where you have different groups or different individuals interacting, sometimes clashing, but always bringing their own world visions to the place where they are living now. And this is something that enriches cultures, that enriches the societies that are hosting the immigrants. So this is not only about crossing the border, but even if you stay in a place, you are going to start receiving all these cultural influences from all over the place and all this information. And I think in any place where we are going to be living at some point in this border condition.
In the novel, Makina is respected in the village because she doesn't lift other people's petticoats, as you say, because she can speak native tongue, Latin tongue and Anglo and knows, as you say, how to keep quiet in all three. She also knows how to handle herself with kind of gangsters or boys who try it on. Did you want to give voice to a kind of character like that, the kind of character that we don't hear from much?
Well, it was a kind of character that I was very interested in. But it's not that I wanted to give voice to this character. It's just that one thing that is really important for me is to listen. You know, listening is, for me, I think, one of the most important things that a writer has to do. So very often, the kind of character that Makina is thought as a marginal character. What I think is that these kind of individuals, these kind of characters, are fundamental in our society. And if we just start listening to them, we will find out a lot of important things about ourselves and about the way we interact in our society. So yeah, it was very important for me to develop the story through this character.
Is this a kind of project of listening that you undertook? Because, I mean, it's something of a challenge for a literature professor such as you to know what it's like for a young Mexican woman to make a deal with a bunch of gangsters or to row across a border in an inner tube or whatever, or to go knocking on doors to find a brother who disappeared 3 years ago. Is that how you set about it, by going out to find people who'd lived these experiences?
Well, you know, I am a professor right now, but I have been other things and I have been traveling around a lot. And I like to think that my life and my worldview is not limited by my present job. I spent most of the year here, but I spent at least 4 to 5 months in Mexico. And I get involved in the political life, and I see all my friends that are not related to my work in the university. So, yes, I try to feed myself with the current reality in Mexico, but also at the same time, I try not to be limited by what the media or the government tell us that what is reality. I remember, I don't know if you saw that speech that Ursula K. Le Guin gave a couple of months ago when she received an award, and she was saying that we need realists, but we need realists of a wider reality, meaning by that we need writers of the imagination, that we need writers that don't stop just on what it has been understood as a realistic depiction of the world.
Your translator, Lisa Dillman, talks about how your prose in Spanish plays with standard usages, mixing high and low registers, rural and urban, as well as forging brand new words like your yarchar for to leave, mm-hmm. which she's rendered in English as to verse. Is this polyphonic language of the novel an attempt to measure up to the language that the people Makena meets over the border, the people who are both homegrown and Anglo with rabid intensity, the people who speak what you call an intermediary tongue that is malleable, erasable, permeable? Is it kind of trying to match up with that usage?
Well, it's part of it, but it comes also from something that I'm convinced of, is that all registers of the language are the materiality I work with. Every single expression of the language I work with, either if it's an old one, either if it's popular or if it's an educated register, all of them are my patrimony. I own them as much as any other Spanish speaker, and I don't want to separate them as if they couldn't work together to put forward the story. So, yes, what I'm doing here with the story of Makena is mixing different registers, not only from different social spheres, but from different centuries, from different countries, and in order to create a different language just for this text.
You seem tremendously optimistic about the power of language. In the novel, indeed, Makena manages to magic herself out of a very tricky situation just by scribbling 10 lines of prose. Do you think that language, that writing, holds the answer to the terrible problems of division and inequality which we're confronted with?
Well, it can be. It's not a magical solution. Language can be used to justify atrocities too. But regarding this, what I will say is the same thing that I say about books. Reading does not make you a good or a bad person per se, but by reading you have the opportunity to become a critical citizen. And with language, you can assume the responsibility of your own acts, and you can use language as one of your acts, you know. But also you can use language for the bad, or you can use language to dominate or to humiliate. So, yes, I am optimistic about the possibilities of language, but I know at the same time that it's not just an automatic solution.
Yuri Herrera. Signs Preceding the End of the World is translated by Lisa Dillman and published in the UK by And Other Stories. And now to Valeria Luiselli, one of 20 writers under 40 to be included in a new anthology, Mexico 20, which was launched at the book fair in a joint project between the Hay Festival, the British Council and the Mexican cultural organisation Conaculta. We tracked her down to one of the spin-off events from the book fair at London's Shoreditch House, where she introduced us to The Story of My Teeth, a colourful tale of the world's greatest auctioneer.
Without further ado, I gave a half turn, moved toward my dental collectibles, picked up the first lot, and holding it high as I walked back to the pulpit, like a priestess in full Delphic trance, I began my chant, with the skill and charm of which only the greatest of my stripe are capable. Hyperbolic lot number one. Our first lot is a piece in a somewhat deteriorated state. Yet, considering its antiquity, the overall condition is good. One might even say excellent. Significant flattening of the point leads to the supposition that the original owner, Mr. Plato, talked and ate continuously. He was 5 feet 5 inches tall and 33.5 inches broad. He was of medium height but robust, with a fighter's build. He had a long, cotton woolly beard, light brown in colour, thick hair of the same hue and texture. Mr. Plato flaunted the conventional fashions of the day and wore his toga loose, without a belt. Neither did he wear sandals. Mr. Plato once made a comparison between the period of dentition and a man falling in love. In this state, the soul enters into effervescence and irritation, and this soul, whose wings are just beginning to develop, can be compared to a child whose gums are inflamed and enervated by its first teeth. Lovely, don't you think? I paused momentarily for greater effect. Wafts of cool morning air were beginning to enter the church through the high main door. I had the sense that a ray of light was falling from the sky, miraculously illuminating the pulpit. I raised my eyes and immediately noticed the altar boy Monje up in one of the galleries, throwing a spotlight onto me. It wasn't divine light, but even so, it filled me with motivation. I took a breath. Ladies and gentlemen, who will open the bidding for the cavernous tooth of our first infamous man? A hand was timidly raised at the back of the church. 1,000 pesos. It was followed by another, more eager hand. 1,500. And another, and another, and another. The lot went for 5,000 pesos. Not at all bad for a warm-up. It was bought by a small, elderly, opulently dressed woman. Quintilian explains that there is in all men a natural propensity to magnify or extenuate what comes before them, and no one is contented with the exact truth. I believe that's why the most worn-out tooth in my collection went for such a high price. I cleared my throat and continued with my infamy.
How did you start writing the story of the world's greatest auctioneer, Gustavo Sanchez Sanchez?
Well, this book came about first as a commission. It was a commission from a big art collection called the Jumex Collection. So this collection is funded by a juice factory, the Jumex Factory. And when I was commissioned this piece, I thought about what I wanted to do and how I was really going to write about the pieces that were going to be exhibited in the gallery, and decided to not do something that was that direct, and rather proposed to write something in installments for the workers in the factory rather than the people in the gallery. And that's what happened. That's what I did. For some time, I sent installments to the factory workers. Those installments were printed in very cheap little chapbooks that were distributed. And about 12 workers decided to form a kind of reading group. They decided to participate in this experiment or collaboration. Their sessions were they read out loud and also discussed and criticized and commented and told stories. Those sessions were recorded and sent back to me in New York. I would then listen to them and take that material apart and then put it back together in another installment.
And so this became a kind of weekly discipline for you?
It became a weekly discipline.
And where did the voice come from? Where did your auctioneer emerge from?
Well, the auctioneer, originally the voice came from an uncle I have who's a salesman and tradesman in a big market in Mexico City, the Central de Abastos. And I was hearing his voice in my head when I started writing. But because this collaboration between the workers, and it was a kind of back and forth thing, and I was hearing all these voices all the time. There were a series of voices that I became interested in, and there was one voice in particular that I found very, very charming and started kind of emulating or copying. And I think the final voice is an amalgam of those two voices.
And how did they react? Because you originally presented yourself as Gustavo. How did they react when they found that, in fact, you were a young female student in Colombia?
So there's a slightly pejorative way of calling woman in Mexico, which is vieja, which means like oldie or something. And there's not really a literal translation. Almost like old hag. I don't know. What would it be in English?
Old bint.
Bint, that's a nice word. It's less pejorative than men, probably. But when I recorded a message saying, thank you very much for all of this, I heard one voice among the voices saying, oh, ya era vieja. It was really funny. They were, of course, very surprised that I'd been a woman. Not all of the workers were men, I must say. There were some women. And I think they all were surprised that I was a woman. I'm really glad I wrote under a pen name. I think the reception would have been very different.
But they didn't feel disappointed or betrayed?
No, there was no betrayal there. They had been reading a piece of work. It was very clearly fiction, also, what I was writing. I wasn't sending them letters.
But, I mean, readers of the novel will know much of this already, because in the edition published by Granta in English, there's not only a chronology created by your translator, Christina McSweeney, but also an afterword where you recount much of this story of collaboration. How do you think these texts reflect on the novel and change the experience of reading it?
Well, it's the way you put it, it's almost like a meta-story of the novel, because the novel very much reflects on how narrative modifies the value of any given commodity, be it an art piece or a book, a narrative around it, not only what's inside it. So of course, this story that I just told you is kind of like the narrative that envelopes the book and that somehow endows it with a kind of aggregated value, and which is precisely what I'm talking about in the book, just that I'm talking about art objects and narrative around those objects more than anything. So I was careful and I was hesitant to include an afterword, but we decided to leave it there. I often don't read afterwards, so we said, well, let's just leave it there at the end. Most people don't read them. If they do, well, they'll have to rethink what they just read in those new terms. But it won't determine their experience of the novel from the outset.
Highway spends a whole episode in an art gallery where he's harangued by a video installation of some clowns, one of whom tells him, if you cross the boundaries of eccentricity, what's on the other side is buffoonery. You're a clown. Is this novel merely eccentric, or is it clowning around?
Well, I would say that the narrator is a total clown, but I think quite a lovable one, since there's a vulnerability at times and an innocence that makes him quite likable. But, of course, he's always borderline buffoon.
He feels, in a way, very 19th century. There's something of a character from Balzac or Dickens in him, but his story is bang up to date in the 21st century. Did this straddling the two zones come out of the process, the collaboration?
Well, yeah, he's kind of like a proletariat dandy, I guess, but if that can be said. He does bring together those two worlds in many ways. And, yes, I mean, I appropriated many formats and processes for this novel, and one of the things that I appropriated was just the kind of installment feuilleton novel that's written in episodes weekly, and that because of that very format determines a kind of tone, a rhythm, and the very episodic nature of the narrative.
His last idea for an auction is a series of allegoric lots, which name-check some of Mexico's most exciting writers, like Yuri Herrera or Guillermo Fadinelli, and indeed Valeria Luiselli. Is this a kind of manifesto, a kind of statement of intent?
Not really a manifesto. It's more like a game of name-dropping. It's absolutely just name-dropping. In which way? I was trying to emulate a processes that go on in contemporary art, in which perhaps an object that is displaced from its original context changes meaning or is modified, or whose value is modified by a displacement. So I was thinking, well, okay, if you take an object out of a gallery, what happens to that object, right? And how does it lose its value and its meaning? What happens when you think of a writer's name as if it were an object and kind of shift it around, displace it? And that's what I did. I kind of emptied names out of their original content and moved them around as if they were objects, brought them out of their original kind of network of references and put them in stories that had nothing to do with their original references. And I wanted to observe how that modified the name, like the object itself, the value of it, but also how it modified the narrative tissue. It's almost as if you, what happens, like when you throw a ball into a piece of cloth and see how it modifies how its gravity modifies the shape of a cloth. That's what names that are being dropped are being used as or used for.
How are these names, these namings, these objects viewed at home in Mexico?
Well, there's a certain solemnity in Mexican literary culture at time. It's strange because it's a country with a great sense of picaresque and playfulness and ruse. But at the same time, my feeling is that literary culture is often a bit solemn. And one critic described what I was doing as an homage to... I thought it was a really strange way of seeing it. I am definitely not doing an homage. It was a much more playful thing.
You're having fun. Your wannabe writer, Jacopo de Vorregne, is terrified of irrelevance, he says. Is that the fate of any writer of literary fiction at the beginning of the 21st century?
Oh, absolutely, and they're lying to you. They don't say they are terrified of irrelevance.
Valeria Luiselli. The Story of My Teeth is translated by Christina McSweeney and published by Granta. And that's all from us and from Mexico for this week. Until next week, from me and my producer, Eva Krishak, hasta la vista.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.